appreciate that. I am Alan Dials, and I teach here at Harding University. This is my 10th year at Harding, teaching text courses to freshmen, biblical text courses to freshmen and sophomores, and then teaching upper level missions and church history classes. My academic training is a Bachelor of Business Administration here at Harding. I graduated in 1988, and then from Harding I did a Master's of Divinity at Abilene Christian, graduating there in 1994, and then spent over a decade doing church planting mission work in Prague, Czech Republic, and while there completed a doctorate in church history and historical theology in 2005, and then that same year returned to the States and began teaching here at Harding. I'm a member at the College Church of Christ, just over here across the street, where I serve on the missions committee, teach Bible classes, and serve as one of the elders. I'm married to Laurie, and we have two sons. One is a sophomore here at Harding, and one is a senior over at Harding Academy. And they told me I was supposed to introduce myself, so that's what I've done. Anyway, I'm very happy that you are here this morning for this lecture. The theme, of course, of lectureship this year is renewal and return, based on Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. And so I thought it would be appropriate if I did a class on church history that I would do something along the lines of renewal or return or these types of things. Of course, our movement from Churches of Christ is part of what is known as the American Restoration Movement, a renewal movement. Robert Hooper is doing three lectures specifically on the American Restoration Movement. Welcome, come on in. So I'm going to be looking at some other movements, and I'll be this one at 10 o'clock today, and then one other at 3 o'clock this afternoon. These are parts 2 and 3 of what I had envisioned as a three-part series, but they only had 2 slots for me. So part 1 is being left off, and that's a good thing because I've never actually prepared part 1. But it was going to be on German pietism, and maybe someday I'll have an opportunity to prepare it and attach it. But all 3 of these movements that I would have been looking at, and the 2 that I am, are all connected in one way or another. So German pietism connects very closely to what we'll be looking at this hour, the Moravian Brethren. And then there is a significant connection between the Moravian Brethren and what we'll look at 3 o'clock this afternoon in the Wesleyan Revival or renewal movement in England. And so, got on the screen here the sources that I've used for this morning. I do that because I think you need to give credit where credit is due. Yes, sir? Maybe we can, maybe we can't. You know, if I do that, that means I'll be in the dark. Okay, there we go. So if I can't see my notes, we'll just look at the pictures. So some background on the Moravian Brethren. This was a group that came out of the reform movements in the lands of the Czech King, known as today as the Czech Republic. But this was a reform movement of the 15th century. Started by a preacher named John Huss, who was burned at the stake in 1415 at the Council of Constance because of heresy and rebellion against the Pope. His death did not end his movement, however, and his followers continued agitating and propagating reforms that he had preached, and then going even beyond reforms that he had preached. And they were known as Hussites, and there were 2 major branches of the Hussites. There was a more moderate branch represented by the professors at the university in Prague, and a more radical branch known as the Taborites. Out of the Taborite movement came a group of pacifists who rejected the warfare that the Hussites engaged in as the Roman Catholic Church sent five crusades against them. And eventually the major Hussite groups were overcome in one way or another. But you had this little group of pacifist disciples who survived and united themselves together into an underground illegal sect calling themselves the Unity of the Brethren. And they survived sort of underground illegally for almost 100 years, from the mid 15th century into the 16th century. Of course, in the 16th century, you have Martin Luther and the Protestant Reformation. And so this opens up other options to people outside of the Roman Catholic Church. And so at this point, the Unity of the Brethren sort of merges with the Protestant Reformation. And that's the situation for about another 100 years, until the 17th century. And in the 17th century, in 1618, the 30 Years' War breaks out. And the 30 Years' War devastates Europe, particularly devastating the lands that today would be Germany. But the 30 War year actually broke out originally in the lands of the Czech Crown, in, again, modern-day Czech Republic. And it was a war, at the beginning at least, between the Protestants of Europe and the Catholics of Europe. And when the war broke out in the Czech lands, in the initial phases, the Catholics overwhelmingly defeated the Protestants, such that in the Czech lands, Protestants were given three choices. They could either convert to Catholicism, or they could immigrate, leave, or they could be killed if they wanted to stay. And so, obviously, most of the peasantry was not in a position to immigrate. They were not interested in being burned at the stake or anything like that. And so most of the peasants converted to Catholicism. But those people who were landowners or who had some sort of means, some way of getting off the land, Many of them chose to emigrate, to leave the Czech lands and to seek refuge in other places where Protestants were still in control. And so many of this Unity of the Brethren chose to either emigrate away or to try to tough it out and survive sort of underground again. Their bishop at this time was a man by the name of John Amos Comenius, or Jan Amos Komenski in his Czech name. And he was the last of these bishops prior to the exile. And we'll have reason to mention his name in a moment. So many of them had to flee. Well, that brings us then... Before I go on to Zinzendorf, let me say something about Philip Jacob Spinner. This would have been the first hour lecture if I'd have had it, so I'll give you about three sentences of it. In the aftermath of the 30 Years' War, people in Germany are looking for spiritual renewal. And one of the major forms of the renewal in 17th century Germany was through a movement called Pietism. And Philip Jacob Spinner is known as sort of the father of German Pietism. And he begins to emphasize personal relationship with Christ or with God over doctrinal issues. And many, many people begin becoming a part of this pietistic movement. They gather themselves together in what we would probably call today home Bible study groups for study of the Bible, prayer together, accountability, and so forth. And they become a very influential movement spreading throughout Germany and even ultimately sort of finding a sort of a headquarters in the city of Halle. Am I saying that correctly? Halle. And there they start orphanages and schools and things like that. Well, Nicholas Ludwig von Zinzendorf, and you see his dates on the screen there, he lived from 1700 to 1760. He was a German nobleman whose godfather was actually Spener. And so he is very influenced by German pietism. At the age of 10, Zinzendorf is sent to study at Halle, where again there is more of this pietistic influence. While there at Halle over the years, Zinzendorf becomes very interested and involved in prayer. And he actually starts 7 different associations of people who dedicate themselves to prayer. And ultimately, with 4 of his closest friends, they commit together that upon adulthood, when they become adults, they would dedicate their lives to laboring as patrons for missions, for the conversion of the heathen. Now, this is rather remarkable in Europe at this time because the Protestants at this time are really not doing mission work anywhere outside of Europe. Yet these young men make a decision that that's something that they need to be involved in. Well, fast forward a few years, and you have this group of the unity of the brethren who have been scattered throughout Europe, and yet some of them have remained in the lands of the Czech kings, and they are facing persecution, they're facing suppression, they're facing oftentimes imprisonment, and so they are needing sanctuary somewhere. And the leader of one of these groups is a man by the name of Christian David. And he is commissioned, well, let me tell you a little bit about him. He is raised as a Catholic, but as a young man, he converts to the faith of the unity of the brethren. And so this puts him into this class of illegals. And so he is commissioned to try to find a safe haven for a small group of these brethren. And he travels into the German lands and makes the acquaintance of Zinzendorf. And he tells Zinzendorf of the plight of his group, and Zinzendorf agrees to give sanction to this small group of refugees from Bohemia and Moravia on one of his estates. And so this little group, which consists only of 10 people, migrate into Germany to the estates of Zinzendorf, and they set up their own little community there, which they give the name Herrnhut. That's H-E-R-R-N-H-U-T, Herrnhut, which means the Lord's watch. Not like a watch like this, but from the idea, sort of twin ideas, that they were to be under the Lord's watch. The Lord would be watching over them. And also, they, in turn, would be on watch for the Lord. And so they call their community Herrnhut. Well, it is at Herrnhut that eventually this group, because they have migrated from the lands of Bohemia and Moravia, begin to be called Moravian Brethren. Now, as I mentioned, the first group consisted of only about 10 people. But by 1725, so within 3 years, there were 90 who had joined together at Herrnhut. And in 1727, 5 years after the group arrives there, a couple of significant things happen. The first is that Zinzendorf receives a copy of a work called Ratio Disciplinae. And that is a book that was actually written by Comenius, this bishop of the unity of the brethren, from 100 years earlier. And he reads this book and he is very, very impressed with it. And he is impressed with the teachings and the faith of this group of refugees on his territory. Another thing that happens in 1727 is that this group, that now numbers about 300, has an experience of great spiritual revival on August the 13th, 1727. And they attribute this revival to the coming of the Holy Spirit upon them. 2 weeks later, on August the 27th of 1727, the Moravians begin a prayer vigil. They divide the day up into segments, and they get volunteers to take each segment of the day, and they begin to pray. And they just follow one another 24 hours a day. And this prayer vigil did not simply last a day, nor did it simply last a week, nor did it simply last a month, nor did it simply last a year, nor did it simply last a decade. But for 100 years, the Moravians maintained this constant prayer vigil. This then leads 5 years later to a decision in 1732. In 1732, this little community of Herrnhut heard and answered a divine call. The Lord, to whom all authority in heaven and on earth is given, used these humble refugees to demonstrate again that the weakness of God is stronger than men. Through their dedicated interest, the Church of Christ was stirred and a new era of foreign missions began. And so these Moravians, coming out of the trials of persecution, are convicted through this revival that they attribute to the Holy Spirit, through this constant prayer vigil that they are engaging in, that it is their task to spread the gospel through all the world. And so that's what they begin to do. Already, by the time of this realization, 26 of their unmarried men had begun preparing themselves for mission work. And Zinzendorf himself had been training them. He had been conducting classes for them in a variety of fields, things such as geography, writing, medicine, and of course theology as well, preparing them for the task that lay before them. The brethren became dedicated to the propagation and spread of the Christian faith. Comenius, their bishop of 100 years before, had written as early as 1644 or 1645 that the evangelization of the heathen is an imperative obligation for a living church. And this became the major objective for the group as a whole. And so they began to send missionaries to North and South America, primarily to slaves and to the Indians of North and South America, and to other parts of the world. The first two who were sent out were Leonard Dober and David Nitschmann. Now, Nitschmann is interesting because when you read the early history of the Moravians, there are several David Nitschmanns. And so this one was known as David Nitschmann the Carpenter. And he later is ordained as one of their early bishops. but he is able to secure passage, on a ship as ship's carpenter. And in doing so, he is able to pay the way for himself and for Dober to sail across to the West Indies in 1732 to St. Thomas, where they arrive on December the 13th of that year. Now, they were only going sort of as the groundbreakers. And in fact, Nitschmann only stayed just a few months, and then he returned to Europe. Dober stays a bit longer, but then a year and a half later, in June of 1734, they were replaced by 18 others who had been preparing and getting themselves ready to come over. In that year and a half that Dober had been on St. Thomas, he had managed to make one convert. Well, the Moravians in the West Indies faced tremendous opposition and suffering. They faced opposition because the colonists there were not in favor of missionaries coming in and preaching the gospel to their slaves. They feared slave uprisings, and they were afraid. Think about it in modern terms. You've got, say, over in the Middle East, you've got these terrorists who are willing to blow themselves up, you know, suicide bombings. Why? Because they believe they're going straight to paradise. And so they're willing to do extreme things, and they don't fear death. Well, the colonists feared the same thing out of the slaves. If the slaves become convinced in hope for a better life, a resurrection, then they are more aptitude to take risks that might cost them their life on this earth, such as rebelling against their slave owners. And so the slave owners opposed the Moravians' mission work. They also faced diseases such as malaria, things like that, that they were not conditioned to. And so by January of 1735, basically within about 6 months of their arrival, eight of the 18 had died. However, as a whole, the group persisted. They remained in the West Indies. Some of them moved to some of the other islands. Reinforcements continued to arrive. And by 1750, the Moravians had established a church on St. Thomas with 425 members and had reached many of the other islands as well. The 1730s are described by Hamilton and Hamilton in their history of the Moravians as the great missionary decade of the Moravians. During this single decade, in addition to the West Indies, the Moravians sent missionaries to Suriname, to the Gold Coast, to Algeria, to Russia, Ceylon, to the Indians and slaves of North America, as I'd already mentioned. They also went to Greenland and South Africa, and also were sending folks out throughout other places in Europe as well. And again, this is a relatively small group that is sending these missionaries all over the world. Some of them, they were so dedicated to their calling that some of them even expressed willingness to become slaves in order to reach the new world so that they could proclaim the gospel. A willingness to sell themselves as slaves to be able to get passage on the boats over to the new world. Now, I've not been able personally to document that any of them actually did that. But I have been able to document that they expressed willingness to do that. How many of us would be willing to sell ourselves as slaves in order to be able to reach another part of the world? Now, this was at a time, as I mentioned, when most Protestant groups who were strongly either Calvinistic or Lutheran, but in either case had strong beliefs in predestination, And so these groups really at this time saw no need to evangelize the world. There are several reasons for that that we won't necessarily go into this morning. But theologically, if your view is that God has predetermined who is to be saved and who is to be lost, there isn't necessarily a great deal of motivation to undergo hardship to go preach to people for whom God has already decided. In fact, in the late 1700s, William Carey, a Baptist in London, as he's trying to stir the Baptists up and encourage them to get involved in missions, is told at one meeting, "Young man, sit down. When God decides to save the heathen, he will do it without any help from you or me." And so this was sort of the attitude and understanding that Protestants had in the 18th century. And yet the Moravians are sending missionaries everywhere. I'll take just a couple of minutes to tell you about some of the mission work that they were doing at this time, other than the West Indies. They got word about a Lutheran pietistic missionary who had gone to Greenland, a man by the name of Hans Egede. And they heard that Egede had been there for a long time without much success and that he was very discouraged and was going to be returning to the continent. And so Zinzendorf gets this word. He shares it with the Moravians. And believing that Egede was about to leave Greenland, a group of Moravians sailed to Greenland led by Christian David. Well, when they arrive in Greenland in 1733, Egede is surprised to see them. No one had told him that they were coming. He certainly had not invited them. And they were surprised to learn that, yes, even though Egede was discouraged, he had no plans of leaving. And so they show up there. Egede sort of grudgingly welcomes them. He tries to help them get settled, tries to help them start learning the Eskimo languages that are there, but he is suspicious of them. They, in turn, are sort of condescending toward Egede. They tend to look down on his efforts. After all, he's been there for a long time, has very little to show for his work, clearly doesn't know what he's doing. And Stephen Neal makes the point, church historian, he says, "The newcomers pick on the weaknesses of the old with little regard for what the pioneers have endured." And this seems, unfortunately, to be a common trend in missionaries. Missionaries go over as pioneers, they work hard, they learn lessons through experience and defeat and discouragement, and yet they plug away. And then you have the next wave or the next generation that maybe has more formal training or just more opportunities to learn about mission work. And they go and they show up on the field and they're going to do it right. And they're going to show the old timers how they've messed it all up. And that tends to be a cycle that just sort of repeats. And it's often amazing for the old timers as they watch the newcomers over a period of time reinventing the wheel, making the same mistakes that the old-timers had made and could have warned them about. And so you've got this dynamic going on there in Greenland. But nevertheless, there is some measure of grudging cooperation between Egede and the Moravians. But the Moravians there struggle for 5 years, five difficult years, before they have their first converts. And I think in terms of, you know, the missions that we do today, how many of us are willing to send and support missionaries who have no results in their first 5 years, or 6 years, or 7 years, and I could tell lots of stories about from the history of missions, great works, or works that become great works that in the very early years had little or no response. Well, that's what the Moravians discover in Greenland. But by 1745, 12 years, over 200 Eskimos were attending their worship services. Another story of these early Moravian missions has to do with South Africa and a man by the name of George Schmidt. Schmidt had been born in Moravia in 1709 and comes to Herrnhut sometime before the Great Revival of 1727. Rather than being commissioned to go to the West Indies or to Greenland or Suriname or someplace like that, Schmidt is commissioned to go back to his homeland, back to Moravia. And so he does that with a partner, but is not there very long before they are arrested. And he spends a good bit of time there in prison, but is ultimately released. Goes back to Herrnhut. They commission him this time to go to Austria, which is also a Catholic-controlled territory. And so he gets to Austria. He's there just a short time, and he's arrested there as well. This time, he spends 3 years in a very uncomfortable dungeon. They are constantly pressuring him, trying to get him to recant his faith. He refuses. After 3 years in the dungeon, they set him to 3 more years of hard labor. And eventually, the pressure becomes so great that he is broken to the point that he recants his faith. This ultimately leads to his release. And upon his release, he goes back to Herrnhut, where he expects to be received and supported and encouraged, and instead is sort of given the cold shoulder because of his recantation. And so, feeling a need to prove his faith anew to his comrades at Herrnhut, he agrees to, in 1737, to go to South Africa to preach to the Hottentots of South Africa. And so he does this, facing their great opposition from the authorities, who are Dutch Calvinist Reformed, and again opposing his teachings and his thinkings. He also has success in making converts, but they go out the back door about as quickly as they come in the front door. A lot of backsliding and a lot of difficulty. Eventually, he is ordained by Zinzendorf so that he could perform baptisms. One of the things that's important about the Moravians was the importance that they placed on ordination. One could not administer the sacraments, such as the Lord's Supper or baptism, without proper ordination. And so many of their missionaries go throughout the world without ordination. They are evangelists. They make disciples, they form them into communities of faith, but they are not authorized to baptize or to give the Lord's Supper. And so they have to wait until their bishops come or until someone among them is ordained to serve as a bishop. And so this is what Schmidt faces there in South Africa. And so finally, Zinzendorf ordains him by letter, sends him a letter with an ordination in it, which makes his ordination somewhat irregular. And so he continues to face opposition from the authorities there, some claiming that he is illegitimately performing baptisms and so forth. This is another issue that the Moravians will face in many places throughout the world, is many of their ordinations are seen as irregular and so are called into question by people who are opposing them. And this led eventually to Schmidt being banished from South Africa, and he is never allowed to return. However, 50 years later, Moravians are able to return to the valley where Schmidt had lived, and they're able to resume the work with great success over the next century. So again, Schmidt primarily lays the groundwork for work that then follows later. Well, in 1734, Zinzendorf is able to negotiate a land grant in the new colony of Georgia as a potential refuge for religious exiles. There's no guarantee, you know, over in Europe that there's going to remain safety in places like Herrnhut and other places. And so Zinzendorf is looking for other places where people might go if they need to. And so he gets this land grant in Georgia. And his idea is that it also can serve as a base from which to evangelize among the Indians. And so in 1735, the first nine Moravians, led by August Gottlieb Spangenberg, arrive in Georgia, joined in 1736 by 20 more Moravians, this group led by now Bishop David Nitschmann, who had been one of the first to go to St. Thomas. Now, interestingly, about this group of 20 that come over in 1736, of course, they sail over on a ship. And on that ship, also headed to Georgia to do mission work, were none other than John and Charles Wesley, about whom we will speak at 3 o'clock. Spangenberg, Nitschmann, and others, such as Peter Bowler, pictured here, worked not only then in Georgia, but also began mission work throughout the colonies, and especially in Pennsylvania and New York. Now, in the meantime, the Moravians at Herrnhut had aroused the suspicion of their neighbors and the other nobles who lived around the estate. And this was compounded by Zinzendorf's own ordination as a Lutheran pastor. Nobles didn't do that. You don't go from being a prince or a count to becoming a pastor. And so this really irks people in that area. And so this leads to Zinzendorf himself being exiled from Herrnhut in 1736. And his exile will last about 11 years until 1747. But this ultimately proves to be a blessing for the new movement because it forces Zinzendorf to spend the next several years traveling throughout the world, supporting and encouraging the Moravian missionaries. In 1737, Zinzendorf, who is, remember, a German nobleman, but an ordained Lutheran minister, now himself is ordained as a bishop of the Moravian Brethren. So you've got this German Lutheran pastor who is now a Moravian bishop. And that raises some eyebrows as well. One peculiarity of the organization of the Moravian Church was that although the church ordained its own bishops, let me back up. One of the major ways that the Moravians used to make decisions was by the casting of lots. And they would do this to determine who should be called as a missionary. They would do this to determine who would be called to the ministry, whether or to whom a person should marry. So a lot of things like this, they made their decisions by the casting of lots. And so they reached the point where they decided that they needed to identify someone as their chief elder. And so, how do you do this in the Moravians? You do this by casting of lots. And so they began to cast lots, and the lot would never come out for anyone. And so eventually someone had the idea that perhaps it was because Jesus Christ ought to be their chief elder. And so they decided to put that to the lot, cast the lot, and it came out positively. And so they decided on September the 16th, 1741, that Jesus Christ himself would be the church's only chief elder. And the Moravian Church to this day takes great pride in the fact that while they may have lots of bishops, Jesus Christ is their chief elder. Well, in 1741, Zinzendorf arrives in the colonies, and he works very hard for Christian union among all the German Protestants of Pennsylvania. He understood that in Europe, the church-state relationships prevented fellowship among differing denominations. But in the New World, you didn't have this church-state relationship. And so he believed that he could bring about union of all the German Protestants in Pennsylvania. And for a while, Zinzendorf served as pastor of both a Lutheran and a Reformed congregation in Philadelphia, and then later he served as a pastor of an English Moravian congregation. But ultimately, he failed in bringing about union among these various groups. In June of 1742, Moravians in North America developed a twofold system of membership, with one group being dedicated to missionary work and education, and the second group supporting the first, providing for their financial needs and so forth. Spangenberg had returned to Europe. He had himself been consecrated bishop back in Europe. And so in October of 1744, he returns to North America and takes a very leading role in guiding the Moravian churches and their missions in North America. Hamilton and Hamilton write this of Spangenberg: "He combined unusual administrative gifts with sound views in theology and the zeal of a pioneer missionary. He supervised Moravian itinerant evangelism among the German settlers, directed their missions among the Indians, managed the economic life and enterprises of the settlements, and presided over all the undertakings controlled by the Pennsylvania synods." Now, in North America, the Moravians developed a communal system known as the economy, by which they all pooled their labor for the work of the church. It was not community of goods. They were allowed to possess private property and possessions, but they pooled all their labor. So all the work that you do is for the good of the community and for the evangelization of those that they're trying to reach. And according to Hamilton and Hamilton, the economy nurtured a race of men and women who did not count their lives dear, but held themselves in readiness for any task, no matter how arduous, that would further the kingdom of their Lord. Well, the Moravians were fully invested in the task of taking the gospel to the world. They bought or constructed several ships to transport their missionaries and supplies throughout the world. Can you imagine our churches today buying and maintaining airliners so that we can get our missionaries all over the world? But they were serious about this. They established productive communities wherever they went and became even leaders in educational work, establishing many schools. Unlike other Protestant groups of their time, the Brethren did not form a little missionary society composed of a small minority of interested members. Rather, for them, the whole church was that society. That was the work of the church. Now, they did have mission societies over different regions and so forth, but it was everybody participating, not just a small interested group. Over the years, the Moravian Brethren faced many challenges: theological, missiological, logistical, political, methodological, organizational, financial, etc. Some faced martyrdom, poor health, lack of supplies, and natural disasters. But in spite of all of the challenges, they never lost sight of their ultimate mission, which was to be constantly and fully engaged in the mission of God to the lost souls of the world. And they become a model and inspiration for other Protestant missionary work of the 19th century, known as the Great Century of Protestant missions. Though a distinctly small group overall, they furnished over half the Protestant missionaries from Europe in the 18th century. Over half, just this little group. Hamilton writes of Zinzendorf: More than any other single person, Zinzendorf became the founder of modern missions. They had two strong convictions that guided them as a movement. Number one, that world evangelization is the prime obligation of the church. For example, during one 20-year period, from the 1730s until the 1750s, they sent out more missionaries than all the other Protestant groups had done combined in the previous 200 years. Between 1733 and 1833, so in that century, they sent 102 missionaries to Greenland alone, to one place. They sent a new missionary on average every year. And then the second major conviction was that this obligation of world evangelization was the personal responsibility of every member of the Christian community. All Moravians were expected to be evangelists, whether they were at home or abroad. Now, they recognize the difference. Sometimes I bristle a little bit when people say all Christians are missionaries. Well, that's not really true. Mission work is a specialized work of going cross-culturally and learning language and things like that. But all Christians ought to be at some level evangelists. And the Moravians saw that. In their first century of existence, their ratio of missionaries to members was estimated to be one missionary for every 60 members. If you take 2 million members of Churches of Christ, I think that comes out to something like 33,000 missionaries. And what we've actually got is somewhere between 600 and 800, according to the best data we've been able to collect. One in 60. Those brethren who did not go as missionaries supported those who went from the sale of their produce. For them, missions was not just an adjunct to church life. It was church life. It wasn't just a line item in a budget that can be cut when things get tight. It was what they were all about. Now, the Moravians were not perfect. Zinzendorf greatly neglected his wife, Erdmuth, with all of his travels. And according to Tucker, the last 15 years of their marriage was a marriage in name only. Another weakness of the group was that due to a lack of emphasis on doctrinal teaching and an overemphasis on meditating on the death of Christ, many Moravians, including Zinzendorf, who was greatly influenced by his second wife, Anna, drifted into an arrogant mysticism that took their focus off of missions for a time and marred their reputation with others. Another weakness was that because of their approach to finances, which was interesting, Zinzendorf was very generous in using his own resources. He also took out many loans to find out their work. Many of their missionaries were vocational workers, but they had little additional financial support. They would get involved in massive business and educational enterprises that were not self-sustaining. They failed to teach the importance of free will offerings of members, particularly new converts. And so this led the movement to often facing tremendous financial burdens and crises that ultimately led to pulling out of many areas that they had previously entered. And finally, because of their view of the importance of ordination for the performance of sacraments, the Moravians often neglected or delayed the baptism of converts and were sometimes slow in developing national leaders. But we can still learn some things, and I'll try to get this in very quickly. The impetus for the movement came from the witness spirit nurtured in lands of persecution and martyrdom. We see in Zinzendorf the importance of leadership with a vision, leadership that goes beyond just the little details of balancing a budget or whatnot, or deciding what classroom classes are going to meet in, but a true vision for what the people of God can do. This sacrificial mission work was fueled by prayer and Holy Spirit revival. And I'll give you two more. The importance of teaching new converts to give generously and of not becoming overly entangled in and by financial enterprises. then recognizing that God did great things with a small movement because they were willing and dedicated to His mission. And so I leave you with this question. What about us? Thanks for being here, and hope to see some of you at 3 o'clock.